My name is John O'Neill. I'm a staff chaplain at the Washington Corrections Center in Shelton, Washington, commonly called a correction center. However, it is a prison, one of four major prisons that we have in the state of Washington. Walla Walla, commonly referred to as the Walls or the Joint, Monroe, at Reformatory at Monroe, Washington, and McNeil Island, which was federal and is now state, also called the Joint. Every penitentiary in the state, probably in the United States, is called the Joint. They kind of talk about it, the inmates kind of talk about it like you would talk about your alma mater. Oh, I was up the Joint 5 years ago. Do you know so-and-so that was in the Joint back in 67? It goes on and on like this. It's a different world. One institution that I have failed to mention that is relatively new, and I'm not sure how, even Fred, whether you have are aware of the we call it the Special Offenders Unit at up at Monroe. Are you aware of that new institution, Fred? Well, that's been going now about roughly a year. It's separate from Monroe. It's an entirely different institution. It sits right next to Monroe, but it's different. It was originally built with the thought in mind of warehousing those inmates who were beyond, quotes, rehabilitation. No hope. Actually having reached the point of being an animal. It's hard to accept that for a human being, but unfortunately we do have that situation. However, somewhere along the way they decided for some reason or other to change that program and set up what they call a special offenders unit or center. It's a 144 bed unit, and it's probably the most sterile edifice, if you want to call it that, that I have ever seen. I've been all through it. I had an opportunity to go there as a part-time chaplain, and they were looking for a nurse practitioner to head up the medical facilities, which my wife had applied for. However, after going through the institution, both of us decided that wasn't for us. Each cell is self-contained. I mean, it has a shower, toilet, complete facilities so that man could be put in there, never come out. You got slots to feed him, iron bed, little windows way up high, and a TV camera monitoring everything he does. They have a central control facility where the guards sit there. Everything is monitored by TV. You can watch the whole institution in sections going on. Every door is operated by electrical buttons. I can only relate it for me, compare it to the pictures I've seen of Star Wars and a platform that flies around up there and does crazy things. That's what hit me when I went there. It's a 144 bed unit. And what they're doing now with that, each institution can make application for sending an inmate there, and generally they're trying to take those cases that are borderline psychiatric cases, I guess that's the best way I can describe them, and try to do a behavioral pattern change with them. And they seem to be having some fairly good success with it. It's a group of specialists, psychologists, psychiatrists, counselors, headed up by a man by the name of Tom Rolfe, who has been in the criminal justice system for a number of years. I knew Tom when he was at Shelton 12, 13 years ago. Just a real, real concerned man, but a very firm man and a very good superintendent for that institution. I've seen a couple of the cases. What they do, they go through steps. They start them out, step one, whatever that entails, which is mainly getting acquainted with them and trying to get some handle on where they are. And then they go through steps. And the program for an individual can last up to 2 years. And at that time, he's either ready to go out on parole if his time is up, or work release, camp, or back to his parent organization. I have seen three now that I'm aware of that came back from that program after about a year, and the ones that I'm acquainted with have been back about 6 months now, and comparing their behavioral pattern now as to what it was when they went, it's just 180 degrees better. So I have to feel that there is help has been offered there. That unit costs the taxpayer, the last figures I had were $174 per day per inmate. That's what that costs. Yes.
How does that compare to what it costs in Shelton per day per inmate?
Shelton, the last figures I had on that, you have to understand as the population goes up, the cost comes down per capita. The last figure I had on Shelton was about $67 per day per inmate. Now, I think that's dropped some with the increase. Walla Walla, about $35 to $40 per day. Purdy Treatment Center for Women, around $74 per day per inmate.
Does that subtract from the total cost goods or services, products manufactured and or supplied by the inmates in that institution?
Unfortunately, there is not... Are you talking about kind of a prison industry thing? Is that what you're referring to? Or the work that the inmates do to maintain operation in the prison?
Right.
Is that what you're saying, the latter? Yeah. No, that does not... That's the cost per capita per day...
To the taxpayer.
Beg your pardon?
To the taxpayer.
To the taxpayer, yes. Right. Purdy Treatment Center for Women, $74 a day. McNeil Island, I think... because of the state taking it over and trying to put it back in shape and get it operating again, has cost is a little bit higher, somewhere around $50-some per day per inmate. McNeil Island started out with, I think it was 250 when they first took it over, and that was kind of what it was going to be. At least that's what people were led to believe. By the first of the year, it went up to the first of last year, I guess it was, first of this year, rather, something like 500. And I think now they're pushing up around 800. No, I'm talking about inmates. Yeah, that's per day. No, not dollars. I'm talking about inmates now. And I guess they're looking at 1,000. Before too long.
Why did the federal give it up?
I don't really know. I've heard a lot of things, and I don't really have any handle on the real reason, official reason. McNeil Island was pretty self-contained. It was one of the least expensive institutions to operate in the federal system because it had its farm, did all of its own furniture manufacturing, just a lot of things. And it was the least expensive to operate. But the question, or the reason that I've heard mostly is that people felt that it was, or that the government felt that it was too old to continue with, cost too much to keep it up. However, it's, I go over there quite often, and it's the stereotype prison that you've seen movies of. You know, you stand down there in the, on the tier and you look up, five tiers up, and all cells and so forth, cell blocks, tiers. But then as they go from maximum security to medium security to limited, to limited minimum to minimum, they progress into different housing and a little more freedom. I have figures on the camps and Furlan. I don't. They're all within that bracket of cost and so on. I wanted to mention that special offenders unit because it's brand new and it's in a way a step toward rehabilitation and treatment, which I'm going to touch on this morning, and then go into some of the alternatives to incarceration. As I was kind of exuberant with what I thought I could cover in 5 days. So I had a lot of stuff here, and I have not kept up with it. But be anybody that's interested in some maybe things I haven't touched on, I'd be very happy to do that. I'm going to share with you a little bit this morning. I just mentioned it yesterday, but this is a proposal that was submitted for treatment and rehabilitation by a longtime con, one whom I'm personally acquainted with and consider a friend, and just a neat guy. I guess Dell is 50-some years old now. He's been a tough con. He was a con boss at Walla Walla. There was a movement some years ago to move some of the tougher cons out of Walla Walla into Monroe and Shelton, guys who had kind of turned their life around, and they had a lot of respect for, that is, custody had a lot of respect for, and trusted, to use them to deal with the younger cons, to help them to straighten their lives out, guys that were interested in doing that. And for whatever reason, it went along fine for a while and things were pretty cool in the units, and then they changed their thinking, and I really don't know why. And another part of that, the other side of that coin is that two or three of them that I'm aware of, and specifically Dell, gave a lot of his time and energy to help these kids that we're dealing with in the institutions and down at Shelton, and was very successful at it. And unfortunately, there's no consideration given him at all for what he has contributed. None whatsoever. It's really a sad situation. Dell should be out. Granted, he's tough con, he's done some not a murder type, basically non-violent crimes. He's a heist man or a held up armed robber, basically, big stores and that type of thing, not the corner mom and pop grocery store thing, but he went at it big. Alcohol problem for years, kind of, that's kind of where he came from. Well, Dell has burned out. He's realized he has turned his life around. We have in this state the Habitual Criminal Act, what they call bitching, which says after a man has been convicted three times, I believe it is, that they can hit him with the bitch, which means a life sentence of 13-4. Well, Dell is in that bracket, and I think he's looking at 1990 or something like that. You know, and it's really ridiculous. This man should be out doing something because he's got a lot to offer and wants to do it and has really, really turned his life around. A lot of us are working to try to get something done for him because we feel that it's really necessary.
That point should be used in an element of fear, and it doesn't seem to permeate the population. They should use that as fear to keep them from doing that.
How do you mean
okay.
Fear?
If you commit three crimes,
okay,
that's it.
Mm-hmm.
And they should be afraid to do it, but they're not afraid to do it.
Fear does not change much of anything. I don't care what it is. Let's take a smoker, for instance. You know, we know from statistics what's going to happen. Not in all cases, but by and large. But sure, it's deterred some, but a lot it hasn't. An alcoholic, somewhat the same way, you know. And, you know, Hitler tried to control Europe through fear, his own country, through fear. Countries are controlled through fear for a while, and then people won't handle it any longer. Fear doesn't do much for a while, but not much. With the kids going out, you know, boy, they say, hey, I'm never coming back to this joint again. I've had it. No more. Well, they get out, and they get back into the society and their own pattern again, and if they haven't gotten a handle on something, that fear wears off. They forget about the bad things, which most of us do in our lives, and think, remember the good things. So I mean, there's some, you know, some good things happen to guys in prison once in a while, and they think about those. And they forget, and bang, they're back in. So fear really doesn't do it. But anyway, Dell and group got together, and they put forth an excellent proposal here. And I'm not going to go through it all. I'm just going to deal with the introduction because I think it's very good, and it really deals with what we're talking about. We'll lead into some of the rehab and incarceration, alternatives to incarceration. This is the introduction, and it starts out with the needs of the imprisoned. And you may agree or disagree with this, that's fine, no problem. Correctional history hasn't been so kind. Today's investigators proclaim the disheartening news that our prisons are a failure, and their findings are so thorough that they allow little latitude for discussion. However, we may do well to recall that the history of nearly all success is a story of failure. Leads to some hope. Part of the problem comes from lack of continuity between the various branches of the correction structure, that meaningful data and feedback is lost because it is deemed unimportant or insignificant. It is human to judge, and equally human to be mistaken in judgment. But once error is perceived, it must certainly be wrong to continue along the same course. At present, we deal with a dictomy of guilt, the prisoner for lack of social conformity, and the system for failure to modify social behavior of his wards. The prisoner of this day and age is quite disillusioned by the fact that it took 200 years for the penal system to discover that it is malfunctional. And, in spite of this discovery, the system continues to thrive and to do business as always. This condition does not contribute to an atmosphere conducive to rehabilitation, even in situations where individuals desire rehabilitation. It is psychologically imperative that the patient must have faith in the doctor if positive results are to be anticipated. Even more is the need to abolish the we and they construct that currently prevails both among prisoners and throughout the free social world. We, the prisoners, by simple virtue of membership in a social subculture, can never comfortably seek membership in the they, the free society. Many prisoners have such long-standing records of membership in the we that their psychological attitudes are entirely formulated by these influences. Certainly, it is one thing for the doctor to fail in his attempt to cure the patient, But when further contamination is introduced, more than just an eyebrow should be raised. The contemporary schools of sociology are bringing many innovational approaches to the problems that surround the social deviant and the criminal offender. Correlations have been established between deviance and environment. In fact, the correlation is strong enough to prompt prisoners to exonerate themselves of their criminal guilt and fix the blame squarely upon the social conditions that he feels produced him. It is their manner of conditions that inhibit the prison system and prevent progress in the area of corrections. The needs of society. The law-abiding citizen in the free community is entitled to the fullest protection of government, since the government is a taxpayer's subsidy. When violent crime is on the increase, public concern must necessarily increase proportionately, and in turn, government must act. The question is, how? Prison and punishment fail to produce the desired results, and large-scale treatment has proved unsatisfactory. Truly, the problems are multiple and disturbingly complex. The interests of society tend toward the right to be secure in their property and their persons, and it may be quite reasonable to assume that little concern is given to the means to this end. Therefore, the issue becomes one of rights, a society versus prisoner situation, where, to a great extent, ignorance and misinformation prevent a fair trial. Society desires protection, and so does the criminal. Building more prisons does nothing for the criminal and only further burdens the taxpayer. Lessening the prison sentences without treatment modifications increases the crime threat, and increasing the physical punishments of prison has already been proven useless. So what is left? Treatment is the only answer that should any longer receive consideration. And by treatment is meant a program logically designed to accomplish the desired results, which should be resocialization of criminal deviants. Never in the pages of history do we encounter an example where psychological and sociological problems have been solved by the architect. One additional factor that deserves mention is also based upon historical reflection. Societies tend to resist taking constructive actions or solving complex problems during periods of relaxed tensions. When the pressure is on, these same societies immediately respond to the issues, and the proper remedies are usually found. The real problem is one of changing people, not changing environments. One additional element should be introduced: positive environment. To fully appreciate what is implied by this expression would require far more space than is available for the purposes of this proposal. However, brief reflection upon the prisoner we construct should provide some insight into the specifics that we tend to regard as negatives. For any program to succeed behind the walls of a prison, a very conscious acknowledgement must be made of all the defeating factors that can, if allowed, enter into destructive competitions with the programs, goals, and objectives. How often does it happen that a man makes a resolution with self to become a better person and to take advantage of various programs to assist him along the way, but before he has progressed too far, he is pulled down by the adverse and negative environment around him? It is only proper that men, desiring the full benefit of self-modification, should be entitled to facilities that are not only not defeating, but additionally provide positive encouragements. It is precisely here that we bring about the eventual decline and fall of the prison we construct. As a man thinketh, so is he. The man's values are unquestionably a matter of differential association. The kindest man in the world could only maintain kindness just so long if he were constantly exposed to an environment that reverses hatred and violence. Fortunately, however, the reverse is also true. The process of positive programming can only succeed only if all negative fears and anxieties are eliminated from environmental atmosphere. Now that comes from specifically one inmate who has lived through, survived the system. And I think it's some tremendous insight there for a man who has really turned his life around. And that's basically, this is Adele I'm talking about. We feel needs some, hopefully, to get him out one of these days. Because he really has something to offer to us. Things that he speaks about in a negative environment, obviously these people are negative, probably came out of a negative environment, most of them. And they're just continuing the negative environment. And just by the nature of our system, everything is by number. There's no real human, real close contact between inmate and custody staff justified, built into the system. And necessarily so, because it's impossible for custody staff to deal with these people if they get too involved with them, and they just don't allow it. Because the other side of that coin is that we've got a large percentage of real con artists in there. And it's impossible for any of us to know 100% whether this guy is conning us or not. And they're past masters at it, some of them. So they have to be very careful. So consequently, what you wind up with is a group of numbers. People become institutionalized, and they just, you don't hardly know them. You don't know the person, you know the face, you know a number, and that's about it, the way they deal with them. I have instances of people coming up for parole. One case that really stands out. Here again, our parole board made up of seven people who, going out here, I think Fred said next year, I'm not sure if it's next year, but. And we're going to determine its sentencing. But the parole board is dealing with an overload that they no way can handle. Normally what happens is they work in pairs, and the two will come to Shelton, two go to each of the other institutions. And they're going every day. It's a full-time job. But I had a young man who had a 5-year maximum sentence. And he came up before the board, and the board looked at him, called him in, talked to him a minute, and he said, well, we're going to set your minimum as 6 years. The guy looked at him and says, hey, how do you come up with that? I only have a 5-year maximum. You can't do that. And they can't. Oh, is that right? Well, step out. They went through his file. Because I happened to be in the board. I was sitting there when this took place. So they called him back in. They said, well, we're going to give you your maximum is your minimum, 5 years. How'd you arrive at that? Well, you haven't been programming, you haven't done anything to help yourself. The guy says, hey, wait a minute. I've gotten everything that they had to offer here in school. I've done vocational training, and he had, it was a matter of record. He had nothing but good reports. So they said, okay, we have to look at it. Step out again. They made him step out again. Go through his record again. And they came back in, they gave him 30 months. Well, the point I'm making there is that the board, and I'm not trying to demean the board at all, I'm trying to say that they're human beings, they can only handle so much. They don't get an opportunity. The opportunity is not there for them to be able to go over the record and say, this guy is, and read the pros and the cons and say, hey, this guy is doing pretty good, maybe deserves a break. Hey, this guy isn't doing it. We gotta give him what they call a flop, carry him on for another year, see him in another year, whatever. They just don't have the time. And here again, that's because of our system and the overcrowding and the increase in crime. These are some of the things that we're dealing with. Yes?
What is the background of those on the board and the parole board? What education or...
Well, I can't answer that completely for everybody on the board. I happen to know of two in particular. Mostly are professional men.
In what field?
Most any field. Some of them are businessmen. Some of them are the parole board is kind of, the governor appoints to the parole board. Yeah, the governor appoints to the parole board. Normally the way I understand they do it, in fact I know the way they do it, a group of names are submitted and it's boiled down to three, and then three names are submitted to the governor and the governor picks one of those three. It, in some cases, is considered a political appointment type thing and so forth. However, Father Namas, who Catholic priest, was on the board for some time. And I talked to Father Namas a little bit. He resigned from the board. And I asked him, I said, what do you think? And he said, well, to be very honest, and very literally, I used to go home at night and throw up. He said, I could not handle it from where I come from as a Catholic priest, man in the ministry, and take day after day the way we have to deal with these people. Now, he wasn't pointing fingers. He was just saying, that's the way it is, and that's the way it affected him, and he resigned. Blame you want into that, yes.
The frightening part about what you just told us, though, is the flip side of that coin. Because if they are not, if they being the parole board, are not being fair to the parolee or to be, because of not being able to look over his records and making mistakes in judgment, then we have the other side, which is there is a lot of cases on record which they release before they should.
Yeah, I don't have any argument about that.
It's a real dangerous situation.
Right, right. It's one of the pitfalls of our system. And I'm not sure that determinate sentencing is going to change it much either. Because you see, as I mentioned yesterday, and a gentleman said to me last night, I don't see him here today, but he said, I never thought about the fact that you stated that 98% of these people are going to get out sooner or later, parole board or no parole boards, determinate sentencing or no determinate sentencing. When their time is up, they got to go. They may serve their maximum, but when that maximum is up, they got to turn them loose, unless they have committed another crime within the institution.
A few years ago, our firm remodeled the kitchen at the Walla Penitentiary. And as we went through the first day to look over the site, the head maintenance man that we went through with talked to virtually every prisoner we went by and called them by name. And it really amazed me, virtually everybody. And he said he knew 2/3 of the inmates by name.
Mm-hmm.
They came up to him because they wanted to have some contact.
Right.
They thought, if they made friends with everybody, would help on their parole.
Well,
I'm really impressed with you.
Yeah, you have many, many ways and means of trying to impress the parole board. Marriage is one of them. If a guy's got a stable family to go to, so if they get married while they're in the institution, they've got a family to parole to. Religion is another. They use that fantastically, what we call writing the Bible out of prison. That's used all the time. We're aware of that. And we pretty well generally have a pretty good handle on that. So, no, which is going. I'd like to go into a little bit the real value of prisons. If prisons do not deter crime or rehabilitate offenders, what purpose can they serve? Prisons are necessary roughly for 20 to 25% of the prison population. Violent offenders, murderers, the Mansons, so forth. But there's another 70 to 75% that can be made useful citizens. And these individuals must be kept in prison for the protection of the general public. That's true. We do have to do that, up to a point. Yet every opportunity should still be offered those who must be confined to rehabilitate themselves. I have to stress this. We know we get into this dynamic of a lot of times called do-gooders, and we want to do this. We're going to change this guy's life, and we're going to change that guy's life. Well, we're not going to change this guy's life, and we're not going to change that guy's life. There's no way that you or I can do that. That person has to be motivated to do that himself. We are mandated through the gospel, through our church, through our society, to provide that man with the necessary tools to rehabilitate himself, to change his lifestyle. Whatever those tools may be, and they're different for each individual. That is where we, as taxpayers, society, get into the act. One phase of it, not all-encompassing. As I said earlier, you can't repair an automobile or this village if you don't have some tools to work with. You got to have something to work with. If prisons do not rehabilitate and are only necessary for violent criminals, why haven't we come up with some better and cheaper ways of dealing with the nonviolent majority of offenders? And the answer is simple. Change in criminal justice policy and practice is notoriously slow. Most Americans simply don't care what happens in prisons and are prepared instead to spend the money necessary to incarcerate hundreds of thousands of criminals. The public doesn't understand the enormous cost of prisons, nor just in not just in money, but also in lives and in public safety. Nor is the public aware of our penal system's incredibly consistent record of failure. Meaningful prison reform will come about only when the public sees both the failure of the present system and the advantages of the alternatives. Prison reform, a matter of life and death and rehabilitation. Now, we are very fortunate at Shelton. We've had a few knifings, only one critical one. He didn't die, but he came close. We had lots of beatings, some that are never reported because the prison code says you may be beaten up, but you don't talk about it. You say nothing. Because if you go to the guard and ask for help or protection, you're a snitch and you're dead. That's fact. That's reality in prison. Each inmate has the prerogative of what he calls checking in. If a guy gets raped, kid gets raped, he doesn't say anything about it. Because he doesn't dare. And unfortunately, it's the young kids, good-looking young kids that come through down for the first time that become the victims. They prey on them. Man's inhumanity to man never ceases to just throw me. I would think that here all these guys are in the same situation basically and they would look out for each other, but they don't. You have a young fellow that may get money from his family to buy stores. They have an inmate store and the money goes on the books and they're allowed to buy up to, I think it's $30 a week they can spend if they have it, for shaving cream, candy, magazine, that type of thing. Cigarettes, tobacco, radios, all kinds of things. Kid can go to stores and come back from stores with his goodies, and he walks on the tier and there'll be other guys laying for him. They don't have any money and they'll rip him off, take everything he's got. And he doesn't dare say anything. Because if he does, he's really had it. If there's a fight goes on, they get written up. What they call written up, infractions. And I tell them, you know, I deal with the kids, particularly if I'm working in the reception center and I know this kid's going over to the training center and he's a young kid, you know, I spot him. And he's prey. And if he's a good husky kid, I tell him, hey, get your back to the wall and slug it out. You're going to get it written up, but you're protecting yourself. And they'll write him up. Everybody gets to fight, and both sides get written up. It doesn't make any difference whose fault it is. And hopefully, there'll be some understanding why that fight took place. Not always. There's more rape goes on in prison than there is outside the walls. It's a sad fact. It's a brutal fact. Alternatives to punishment. Restitution. Restitution requires the offender to repay the crime victim for property loss or property or personal damages. Through an alternative to prison, a restitution sentence is not an easy out. The offender's schedule is rigidly controlled, often through his or her return at the end of the work day to a halfway house. The offender's pay is diverted into channels beyond his or her control. Repayment of the victim, compensation of the state, supporting the offender's family, and establishing a capital reserve which will help keep an offender from being impelled back toward crime by poverty after release. Because of growing public concern for crime victims, the restitution concept holds great promise of gaining broad support. Many surveys, for example, indicate that a high percentage of Americans would prefer to have a nonviolent offender repay his victim rather than serve time in prison at public expense. Likewise, offender's repayment is preferred over governmental compensation of crime victims through tax dollars. Several states have instituted restitutional programs in which corrections staff may negotiate the amount of repayment, monitor the payment schedule, and in some instances offer employment assistance to unemployed offenders to guarantee that the victim will be repaid. Restitution has gone past the theory stage in dozens of communities across the country. Though problems inevitably arise, as with all new programs, the results have been encouraging. Programs in Florida, Saginaw, Michigan, and Elkhart, Indiana, among others, show both the practicality and effectiveness of the restitution alternative. We do it to some extent in this state, but we haven't really done much with it. Particularly if the guy is, if the person is sent to the Department of Corrections, adult corrections, there's nothing he can do to repay back the damage or the victim or anything else. There's no way. He can't earn any money. Hasn't got any money. I've seen many, many cases where guys, for instance, were committed a crime. They were tried and convicted, or maybe they pleaded guilty. Well, if they plead guilty, they can't appeal anyway. But they were tried and convicted, and then appealed, put up an appeal bond, and stayed out maybe a year working in a relatively good job, no problems, taking care of their family, being what I call a solid citizen. And at the end of roughly, we'll say it took a year for that appeal to come up and be decided on, et cetera, et cetera. And then he lost that appeal, so that says then he has to go to prison. And if it's been the decision to commit him, he loses a job, his family goes on welfare, the victim doesn't get anything, taxpayers lost. So it seemed to me that we are missing the boat in that one particular form of alternative to incarceration. Now, obviously, and no question, that isn't for everybody. But I think we need to look at that. I think our courts need to look at that. I'm not sure how all the legislation dictates to what the courts can do in this state with that. That's out of my area. But I think if there need to be changes made in our legislation, then we should do that. But the only way we can do that is through people like you sitting here. We've got about 12 minutes left here, so I'm going to stop with that one. I'll get into the rest of these, wind this up tomorrow, and I'd be very happy to share with any of you that may have any other questions you want to share. But at this time, I'd just like to open it up to general questions for whatever you'd like. Yes?
It seems to me in the reading I've done on it that most people that are in prison they've been sentenced several times before. They've been on probation. And that it's usually the third or fourth time that they get caught that they actually end up in prison. So they have gone through this many times.
I agree with what you're saying. The biggest percent of these people, particularly the young kids, they worked hard to get there. Through a juvenile situation, they really worked hard. They've done a lot of stuff, and they've been given a lot of chances. I don't know whether you were, I don't know whether I mentioned this yesterday or whether it was last evening, but one thing I feel is that the old-time con, it's been down, he knows. But the biggest percent of the people, a large percent of the people we're getting in, I'm not sure just what the balance is. I kind of tend to feel that we're getting more new ones all the time. Well, we are getting more new ones all the time. But these are younger kids that they've been given probation and so forth and so on. They've been done a little time in the county jail, maybe a little time in the city jail, and in the county jail for a while. Probation, deferred sentences, whatever. And they don't take it seriously. They really don't understand. They haven't been hit hard enough yet. And they get down there to that adult prison that we have, and what they're our reception center, and that's a tough place. That's maximum security. And as I mentioned, I've dealt with these kids and I've asked them, hey, if you knew what you were going to get into down here, how would you have handled your probation or your deferred sentence or suspended sentence or whatever? That I would have taken it much more seriously than I did. And they've been very honest to admit that. So part of what I said was that I would maybe, I don't even know how you'd work it out because it's a tough one to work out, but part of probation maybe should be 3 months in the reception center at Shelton, Washington. I don't know, but that's just a thought. Yes.
Have you seen a documentary, Scared Straight?
I've seen this, the documentary Scared Straight. We have, at Shelton, we've made a program, a videotape, somewhat the same type of tape called Choose Straight. And those are good tools, but they're only tools for the simple reason that you can't take one of those out and show it and expect that to be the answer. Unfortunately, they don't follow up.
I mean, that's more for directly involved people. But I mean that approach of using inmates to confront the younger potential inmates.
That's exactly what we did at Shelton.
You do take the inmates themselves and go out into the community into the jail?
We did. They don't allow us to do that anymore. We can't do that anymore. We made this videotape using inmates, old-time cons, I mentioned before, who came down. This Del Wilson is right in that. He's right there in this tape, this videotape, with a new group of inmates that just came in and dealt with them right at that level, that gut level, just what it was, and pulled no punches. I wanted to bring those tapes up here and use them, but I don't think there's a videotape set up here, or projector, or recorder. Evergreen State College made two videotapes for us, and they're excellent. One of them is outstanding. This Father Namas I mentioned is on that tape, along with some other people, the pro board and judges, and it's a neat tape. Inmates, families, wives, mothers, it's great.
That Scared Straight invitation, there was a post-log to it when it was presented on PBS a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
That statistically there was a dramatic improvement in recidivism for the young people that were presented or confronted on that basis.
Yeah.
Now that was only in that one isolated instance.
Right.
As these types of programs continue to have positive results, dropping the recidivism?
They could have, but you have to follow up. You can't just use that alone. And there's got to be a continual program. For the same reason I mentioned before, what that does is hit them and scares them. And then pretty soon it wears off. We've used it in high schools and things like that.
So they go back into their old milieu again, right back into their old environment.
Yeah, so they consider it a failure. It really isn't a failure because it really wasn't utilized. It's only a tool. It's only one of many, many tools. I use these tapes when I go out to speak in congregations and put on seminars. We like to do ecumenical groups in different areas, and we use these tapes, and they're pretty good. Yeah. Yeah, that's been discussed, I guess, pro and con for X number of years, a product called saltpeter, I guess. First of all, I think if they did something like that, the state is laying themselves open to a wide, big, heavy lawsuit. It's the Constitution. You can't do that without telling people what you're doing. No. They're still human beings. We don't like what they do, but they're still God's children. It's like our own kids. We give them a blistering, but we still love them. We don't approve of what they've done, but we still love them.
But the victims are human
too. The victims are human too. And when I said the other day that the criminal justice includes the victim, that's what we're talking about here. But there has to be reconciliation and healing and forgiveness. And as human beings, that's difficult. We are human. I don't like to get ripped off any more than you do. And it's going to make me angry. And I get angry at some of the stuff I know goes on. I deal with kids that are just sitting in my office with the door closed, just broke down crying. I mean, I feel for them. I have a real concern for these young kids. And some of the older ones, too. They're just beaten and raped. And you go through that. You really see that part of prison. And it's hard. Yeah?
Are the conditions and the rehabilitation percentage similar between men and women?
Mm-hmm. I don't think so. I'm not real sure. I haven't had too much. I've been down to Purdy, the women's institution, a couple of times. I'm good friends with the chaplain there, Bill Carr, and I've talked to Bill, and we've shared things. I think it's pretty much the same. Of course, we have a much smaller female population, much larger now than we used to have. It's on the increase. Women's lib has also invaded the criminal world. They're right in there. And generally, whether we like it or not, they're more vicious. And that's kind of an interesting thing. If they're vicious, they're more vicious. Really interesting what happens there. Yes? Lady back there.
Are you familiar with the book Concrete Mama?
I sure am. Would I comment on it? Well, it's pretty true. Is that what you want to hear? That's one side of it. And everything that's presented there is fact. I have a film available to me that I don't use very often because I would have to take a group of people and indoctrinate them a little bit first before I showed the film. But it's brutal, but it's also fact. Yeah, that Concrete Mama is quite a book. Yes?
I was going to say, if a tape would just save or have one person turn around and rehabilitate himself, it would be well worth it.
Well, I guess it falls into the parable of the 99, prodigal son. It's where we are. I feel it's worth it, yes. Anytime we save a human being or turn a human being around and make him valuable to himself, I think it's great, praise God. We have done that, and that's the thing that keeps us going, some of us. We're able to do that once in a while and see the result.
Yeah. Have you had that book called Faith Chapter 5 about Ted Bundy? And he seems to be able to just work in his way. God, he had everybody caught when he escaped there in Colorado. I mean, and he didn't seem to get beaten up or anything. Well, what he solitary confinement for?
Well, I have not read the book. He may be, well, of course, you see, well, he's a rapo. So that puts him pretty low in the pecking order. He may be, and they may have kept him in, well, first of all, he's on death row.
Yeah, but.
And nobody gets to people on death row. That's the safest place in the prison.
But the way when he was in Colorado, he seemed to make all kinds of demands and they were granted to him.
Well, you know, he was a law student. He was sharp enough to wheel and deal. He was, and, you know, some of these people, if they would take the talent that they're wasting on conning people and ripping people off and turn that to productive things, they'd be fantastic. Well, this paper, you know, you hear that. That man, he hasn't got a college education. He's learned the hard way. But he put that down.
He should be, yes. He could be.
He should have been, yes. But he has changed.
Yeah, he should not be there now.
No. In my opinion. I would trust Dell with anything I've got. I would trust him implicitly. Same way I would trust my family, my daughter, my son. That's my feeling for Dell. And I'm not brainwashed with Dell. I'm smart enough, I think, generally. I don't get them all, don't misunderstand me. I don't get them all. I've been conned by computers.
Persons like that would really be valuable on TV.
Yeah.
Instead of this junk that we have on TV for teenagers, juveniles.
Who would watch it?
He'd be valuable.
If people wouldn't turn him off, yes.
They have some on TV once in a while.
If people wouldn't turn him off. But, you know, we as a tax-paying society would rather look at maybe a soap opera or a detective story or a cooking forum or dressmaking or woodworking or something on TV besides sitting there listening to some guy tell us how lousy our prison system is.
Except if you were to sit on the Dollar Tree show or something like that.
Yeah, I'm sure there's ways it could be done. Don't misunderstand. I'm not saying it can't be done or it shouldn't be done. I'm just saying that generally our people, you know, it's kind of like when you got a black sheep in your family, you know, you keep them in the closet. You really don't want them, all your friends to know about them too much, you know. And we do that with our prison system. You know, we don't want them. No, that's something we'd assume we'd like to do away with it and forget about it. We're paying people to take care of it, yes.
What is the population approximately
of
each of the prisons of Florida in the state?
In this state? Well, I'll approximate because I'm not just sure. I think Walla Walla now is pushing 1,500. McNeil Island is pushing 1,000. Monroe is chock-a-block and it's pushing about 1,100. Shelton, built for 800, is pushing 1,200. That's the major ones.
That's 5,000 people.
That's just in those major prisons.
What will happen when there's no more room?
Build new prisons. We got three on the drawing board. Well, in fact, they're beyond the drawing board. We're taking in, I think I mentioned this statistic before. We're committing to the Department of Corrections 80 more people a month than we're letting out. And that computes out to building a 500-bed prison every 90 days. Can you do that? Build them, we'll fill them. No question about it.
Is it just plain not feasible to keep prisoners in single cells individually so that they can't get at each other to hurt each other?
Well, if they don't get at each other, nothing happens in the cells. They don't, you know, because they work around and usually get a cellmate that they can get along with and type of thing. Generally, the rapes and the beatings happen, they'll drag him into another cell or something of that sort, or get him in the shower or whatever. Basically, I think the reason for 2, 3, 4 man, up as high as, I think there are some 6-man cells, is just economics of space. Shelton, by legislation, was not allowed to have more than one person per cell or room. The last legislature approved lifting that. So now we can double bunk throughout the whole institution. They haven't chose to do that yet. Our reception center, which was built for 240, now can house 480, and they put in steel bunk, double bunked all through that. One unit, as I mentioned before, was a 120-man unit. They double bunked half of it, and now it's got 180 in it. And the last I heard, they were going to continue to double bunk it, and so you can't deal with people in a situation. I don't care who they are. You could take this group right here all of you, and put you in that situation, and I would venture to say that within a very short space of time, you're going to break down, and you're going to be just like any other person locked up in that situation. You can't put people in cages and do nothing. Now, I'm making it sound a little bit worse than this, but not too much. There are some attempts at programming, but budgeting and so forth has changed all that. And it's very, the only programming that we have at Shelton, from the standpoint of behavioral pattern changes, are two psychologists and the chaplaincy. Now, the hall counselors have no time for counseling, because they can't handle the load they've got. Each counselor has about 120 caseload in his hall, and he cannot handle them. He cannot see every one of those that need to see him, and deal with him on a one-to-one counseling type. He's just inundated with paperwork and wiped out. I feel for him, I really do, yes.
Is there any opportunity for, or is there a way that you could have volunteers one-to-one? They do this in our county. Is it too late then? Do they ever do anything like this with Golden?
And on a counseling basis, you mean?
Well, that was in my mind, and also on these people that go in the counters as a friend, I mean, in a way, they haven't had any background doing counseling and such. But.
Yes, to answer your question.
Do they do any of this now?
To some degree. We have a lot, we have groups that come in and visit with the inmates. We have a prison fellowship group. We have Brothers Keeper Movement. There's AA, Alcoholics Anonymous. There's Chicano. There's an Indian group, Muslim group. And they have their meetings, they meet once a week, and they have outside guests come in and speakers and things like that. And those programs are all inmate instigated. They guys get together and they make up their groups, and it's a motivated thing. It's a self-motivation. It's a people who are interested in changing their lifestyle and doing something. And we have those, and we have church groups that come in, and our problem, very basically, is sifting out the sick religions, and we have them. I don't know if you read the article here not too long ago in Lutheran Standard on sick religion. We get many of them, and we have to sift them out. We walk a very fine line as chaplains. We are charged with the responsibility of ensuring religious freedom within the institution. So we have to allow any denomination, recognized denomination, who wants to come in. Pastors, groups, etc. We can bar them only if they start to say or distribute literature that becomes very judgmental or very mine is the only way. I'm dealing with a group now that I have barred from coming in simply because they have a 20th century prophet by the name of William Branham, and they do more toward worshiping him than you do the Jesus Christ. I chop that off.
Do the inmates come to you and ask questions?
Quite often, yes.